So before we begin our Megillah, we have a little bit more of an introduction. We need to know a little bit more. In life, sometimes we have difficulties. Sometimes things get tough. And sometimes things become excruciating. And sometimes a person yells and feels like, I can't handle it anymore. And sometimes it feels like everyone's turned against him. And it's at those times that God looks at us. And it's at those times that we can either soar or sink. And very often we say, well, I couldn't help it. Well, there's this saying going around, I couldn't resist. Right? People do something and they say, I'm sorry, but I couldn't resist. Okay, that's within you and your Creator. It's not my business whether you could or couldn't resist. There was a man who was born out of a difficult situation. His father had halachic difficulties with his mother, so he sent her away, and he was going to marry the maid, and then the mother tricked the father and sent the maid away, and she was in the room instead of the maid. And then when she came back pregnant, the father said, how'd you get pregnant? And she said, I tricked you, I was in the room, it wasn't the maid. And when the baby was born, people were talking, and then when the baby was born, people were saying, you know, maybe he's not fit to even be a Jew, his mother's a Moabite, his great-great-grandmother is a Moabite, and his mother, the whole story, how his mother came to have him. And this little boy, his name was David. And he grew up with this, so to speak, chip, kupashel shratzim, a pack of vermin that he always had to carry behind him. And while all the brothers are being brought forward to show the great prophet Shmuel, David is left out with the sheep because Evin Masu Abonim, he's the stone that everyone was disgusted by. No one had a thought that he has to be there at this important meeting with the prophet Shmuel. And Shmuel goes son by son, and he keeps thinking, maybe this is the one that God chose, maybe this is the one. And finally, he asks Yishai, he says to Jesse, he says, are we finished? No more kids? Because I don't see the one that God wants. He says, oh, there's still one out there with the sheep. And they go and call him in. What? Haitar Rosh Pina, right. And he's the one that's anointed as the future king of the Jewish people. And the sun seems to be shining on David. He goes out and he wins Goliath. The girls are all singing in his honor. They sing about him greater songs than the king, King Saul. And he's successful war after war. His success began as a shepherd. One time a goat was taken by a bear, and he walked up to the bear, grabbed him by the beard, smacked him across the face, and took the goat away. He said, hey, how'd I do that? Must be God's giving me a sign that one day I'm going to have to use the strength for the service of God. He was one of the two people that was given a godly sign that he's got an important job to do in life. David HaMelech and Esther. Two people were given the sign. David, that story with the bear, and Estelle, such a pious tzaddikess, has to be taken to this tarantula that's going to crawl all over her, named Ahasuerus. It can't be that she's taken without some godly intent, some godly plan. So when David is a rising star, his father-in-law, the king Saul, is nervous. He has a problem. This kid is going to overtake him. And so he tries to kill him. And David spends a year or two on the run, almost killed. He reaches a situation where he's on top of a hill and he's surrounded by Saul's men, and he sees no way out. He's finished. And he says, Ani amati bechovzi, I said when I was running and I didn't see a way out, kol adam kuzev, everyone tires. Even the prophet Shmuel, who told me I'd be king, where is my kingdom now? I'm almost dead. And then God sends an angel and saves him. And if this was difficult, the greatest difficulty in David HaMelech's life was still awaiting him. Our sages tell us the greatest difficulty a man can encounter is when he has talbut ra'a betoch beito. When within his home he starts seeing fights and he starts seeing attitudes which are foreign to Judaism, that's the worst thing a person can experience. And so after David HaMelech errs with Bathsheba, which we will study in depth, God willing, the beginning of next semester in our class on Sefer Shmuel, so God tells him, your punishment is that bad things will start happening within your home. And the worst thing that happens to David HaMelech is when his son Avshalom arranges a rebellion against him. This is after his daughter was raped by her brother, Tamar was raped by Amnon. Avshalom had killed Amnon, and now Avshalom has gotten all of the Jewish people practically behind him, and everyone's turned against David. And David is at the lowest point in his life. He knows he's sinned. The Jewish people know he has sinned. Everyone's talking about him. What kind of low life? People are cursing him out to his face. The people have turned from him. The people have went to his son and appointed him as king. His son took his 10 pilagshim to the rooftop and in front of everyone took them into a tent and showed that he didn't act. He took them like husband and wife. And in doing that, he showed the people, I will never again make peace with my father, because if my father makes peace, he has to kill me, because I took his wife. Halachically, I cannot make peace with my father, because halachically, he must kill me if we will ever have peace again. And after that occurs, David HaMelech, he's on the run, he's walking barefoot, he has leprosy, he has teras. The Shekhinah has left him, according to one version, for 6 months, according to another version, for 22 years. He's alone, he doesn't feel like God is with him. And as he's on the run with his men, they don't have food, they haven't had time to prepare, he doesn't have his wife, and he knows that all of the Jewish people have turned against him again, and God has left him, suddenly a voice is heard from the distance. And a man walks up from a hilltop and starts cursing him, and he says, say, get out of here. Get out of here, Isha damim v'isha blial, you men filthy with blood, you lowlife. God has paid you back for everything you did to Saul. Now this is a relative of Saul's. His name is Shimi ben Gera. So great sage, the head of the Sanhedrin. He's the head of the Jewish court. And he's walking on that hilltop and he's cursing David out. Now David and his men are bitter. They're on the run. They don't know if they're going to live. If Avshalom would have given chase that night, Avshalom would have killed him. Their assistance that God gave them is King David prayed, Sakel ma'atzat Achitofel. God, please undo Achitofel's plan, because Achitofel is so smart that asking him for advice is like asking God. And Achitofel told Avshalom, if you give chase now, you'll kill him. You'll have the kingdom. It's all yours. And David left a spy. David left, I don't remember his name right now. He left one of the Kohanim. He said, you stay and you contradict Achitofel's advice. And this person who really was there to assist David told Avshalom, no, you wait, get your forces together, you know, if you try to attack David now, you know how powerful he is, the fact that he's on the run won't affect him. And in truth, if Avshalom would have given chase that day, Avshalom would have killed David. David didn't stand a chance, but because David had left this koi behind, that's what saved him. And so now David doesn't know if he's going to make it. He doesn't know whether or not his son will give chase that night. He doesn't know whether God wants him anymore. And the head of the Jewish court starts throwing stones at him and cursing him. And one of his top men turns to him and says, why should that dog curse you? Let me remove his head. I'll be back in a minute. Let me just take care of it. It's the most bitter time in David's life. And David could say, go ahead. David didn't have to do it. He wasn't going to do it. It was one of his nephews that was going to do it. And he just said, I'll take care of him. Why does David have to put up with this? And at that moment, David says, no. God doesn't want me. And he's a servant of God. And if he's cursing me like this, then maybe God told him to curse me. How do you know that he's wrong? Maybe he's right and I'm wrong. Don't kill him. That man, Shimi ben Gera, was the great-great-great-grandfather of Mordechai. Had David killed him then, we wouldn't have had this whole story of birth. The fact that David restrained himself at that minute and said, don't kill him, that is the source of our redemption on Purim. And the source of our problems on Purim is a story to the opposite effect. We had a person who was a greater tzaddik than David, a man who was tremendous, and very often we get a wrong impression of him. And this man was called Shaul. He was from the tribe of Benjamin. And when he went out to war against Amalek, he was commanded, take care of them, don't leave any behind. And the people kept pushing him and said, no, we have good cattle, let's leave the cattle. we'll sacrifice the cattle, we'll take some of the cattle. And the king, he started begging and begging for mercy. And Shaul was swayed by the people to show compassion where God had said not to show compassion. God had forewarned them and said, take care of them, don't leave any behind. And in so doing, Shaul let Agog live another night. And that night, the maid who was in charge of cleaning Agog's cell lived with him and became pregnant from that night. And from that pregnancy continued the dynasty of Agog until we reach Haman HaAgagi, Haman, who was an offspring of Agag. The fact that Shaul waited that night, he did not listen to what God told him. Yes.
I think you told us this before a long time ago, and I think it was Eitan who asked, was the maidservant Jewish?
I don't know. Sounds like not, right? But I don't know. I don't know. Well, it has to be daughter after daughter. I mean, if she had a son, and that son married a non-Jew.
Yeah, no, I know. Like, it makes it kind of like a contradiction in the offspring.
Not so much, because we know that Haman's grandchildren sat in the highest court in the temple. Haman had grandchildren who became Jews. From the worst sources, we find great leaders. A person should never look and say, well, my grandfather or my father was a wicked person. That doesn't mean anything. We don't recommend that you marry such a person. If you have someone whose father is a tzaddik, so that might be a better idea. But not necessarily. Not necessarily. We find people who came from bad sources. We admire someone who's good, who comes from a good source. But so when we begin our Megillah, we're continuing the story. And when we begin our Megillah, we're going to look at who are our protagonists, so to speak. Mordechai is 10 generations from Shaul. He's a great grandson of Shaul, 10 generations down. And Shaul is 10 generations from Binyamin, a great grandson of Benjamin. Mordechai was one of the rabbis who sat on the highest court in the Lishkas Hagazus in the temple. That means that 70 years later, when this story is happening, he's about 100 years old. Esther, yeah.
What's with this 10 generation thing? We know Noah was 10 generations from Adam, and Abraham was 10 generations from Noah.
I don't know why our sages stress it. If you remind me, then we could take time to look at the Gra. The Gra has a compilation in which he discusses each number and what the numbers represent. And the Gra also has a compilation on Pirkei Avos. And this is the type, I'm sorry, not the Gra, the Maharal. And this is the type of thing which the Maharal would deal with. What's so significant about the number 10? The number 10 represents a wholeness, but there's more to it than that. The Maharal speaks about the wholeness in the number 7, and the number 8, and the number 10. Each number represents, one represents nature, one represents overcoming nature. The numbers have different representations. I never studied this enough to tell you off the bat. We could look it up, but I don't know it well enough to tell you, just like that. We could get to it, but I'd rather take the time to sit down and look at it. I want us to go back to another story. Story of a little girl who's spent her life dreaming of a fine young man. This little girl has been growing up with her twin sister. They look similar. And they know out in the land of Israel, they have cousins. And they're also twins. And everyone's talking how these twin sisters, the daughters of Lavan, Rachel and Leah, so the older one, Leah, she's going to marry Esau. And the younger one, Rachel, she's going to marry Yaakov. And Rachel spends her childhood happily looking forward to that time when she could fulfill God's will and marry the tzaddik Yaakov. And finally Yaakov comes into town, and she's out there to greet him by the well, and they make up they're going to get married. And Rachel warns him. He says, you know, my father won't let me get married before my big sister. So Yaakov says, I'm like his brother. I know how to swindle just as well as him. He won't get the better of me. We're going to make a deal. I'll give you a sign. When comes the night of the wedding, you give me that sign, and I'll know it's you. So Rachel asks him, can a tzaddik be cunning like a rasha? So he says, yeah, and things like this, yes. Tzaddik is not supposed to be a fool. So they make up that that's what's going to happen. And then comes the night of the wedding, and Lavan switches him. And Rachel is standing in the room getting ready with her wedding gown, and Lavan walks in and says, you're not going out there. Your sister's going out. And Rachel's in shock. And again, she has that split second to decide, what am I going to do? She knows she could keep quiet, and Yaakov will catch on to what happened, and he'll stop the procession, and in front of everyone he's going to say, no, you're tricking me, this isn't she. And then her sister's going to be embarrassed. So she could say, well, my sister deserves it. Why is she going in instead of me? She could have a lot of reasons to justify just being silent, not saying a word. And in truth, Yaakov is going to have that issue. The next morning when Yaakov wakes up and sees it's Leah, it's not Rachel, Yaakov's going to have it in for Leah. He's going to say, I understand your sister, she's a tzaddikah. She, okay. But you, how did you do this? Yaakov's going to have a real issue with Leah because he's going to say, why were you willing to take a part in this game? But Rachel, in spite of the fact that she's been spending all the years until now dreaming of marrying Yaakov, and she does not know, no one's promised her that if she lets her sister go in, that she won't end up with Esau. No one told her that let Leah go and tomorrow, 7 days later, Yaakov will marry you. She doesn't have that guarantee that night. All she knows is that her sister's going to be embarrassed if she stays silent. And so she tells Leah, she says, wait, I got to tell you something. Yaakov's waiting for a certain sign. And if you don't give him that sign, he'll know it's not me. So give him that sign so he'll think it's me. And so Yaakov marries her, thinking it's Rachel. And this modesty, this humility, that Rachel was willing to forgo her place in Jewish and world history, that Rachel said, you go. And Rachel didn't know where she would end up. Our sages say that when Esav out in Israel heard the story that Yaakov married Leah, Esav had a good laugh. Esav said, good, I heard the younger one is better looking, so I'll go pick her up for myself. And when Esav said that, word got back to Rachel that Esav said that. So that when Yaakov leaves Lavan on his way back to Israel, Leah's shaking. Rachel's very scared. She knows that they may meet up with Esav, and Esav's going to say, she's mine. You took the older one, so I get the younger one. So Rachel lives her life in the shadow of that fear that she brought upon herself. And nonetheless, Rachel does that. And in the merit that she did that, she merited to have a great-great-great-grandson, whose name is Shaul, the great King Saul. And Shaul was very modest. When he was anointed as the first king of the Jewish people, he didn't go telling everyone. When his uncle asked him, what happened when you visited the prophet? He said, oh, he told us where the donkeys were. He didn't mention that he also anointed me as the first king of the Jewish people. And in merit of continuing this trait of modesty, he merited to have Esther, who was also modest, who didn't brag that she comes from kingly descent. She wouldn't tell the king what family she comes from. And now we come to Vashti. Vashti is either the daughter of Belshazzar or Evel Merodach, different Midrashim. She is the granddaughter of Nebuchadnezzar. And last and possibly least, we come to Achashverosh. There are two opinions in Chazal whether Achashverosh was wise or foolish. Many things that Achashverosh did, our sages have different opinions as to how to interpret them. Was it a smart thing or a stupid thing? Achashverosh said, "Tibatel malchuti velo gzeirati. I'll let my kingdom be overturned, but I won't let my decree be overturned. If I said something, that's the way it's going to be." And we see throughout the Megillah that all his decrees are overturned. Nothing he says holds any water. Achshverosh said to bring his wife naked. She didn't come. In his days, he is remembered for disgrace that the Jews were sold for free. He was willing to let them be annihilated for free. He gains nothing. He begins his kingdom killing his wife for his friend. And he ends his kingdom killing his friend for his wife. Right? He begins by killing Vashti for Haman's advice, Memuchan's advice. And the end of the Megillah, he kills Haman because of Esther's advice.
Where's the proof Vashti was anything bad? Apparently, sages say that she was really bad.
So we have on tradition she was really bad.
But there's nothing in the Megillah.
In the Megillah, so the Megillah was written under foreign auspices. We see that when the Megillah was written, Esther asked the sages to incorporate it in the books of Tanakh, and the sages said, "Kinat noel talenu ben amim." The nations are going to be all jealous of us. They're going to say we're celebrating their downfall. We can't do that. And it seems like the Megillah was written in a way that everything has to be hidden. They can't write Ahasuerus the fool, because Ahasuerus is reading this. This is being written during his kingdom. We're under his rule. So we're more limited as to what could be written in the Megillah. It's written a year after the story. So it's written in a time when Esther is still his wife. That's why the Megillah doesn't openly say Esther is really Mordechai's wife.
So how much is it actually hidden in the...
Most of the Megillah is hidden. God's name isn't mentioned in the Megillah.
But how much of the facts are hidden? How much of the facts are we not...
A lot of it is on tradition, and a lot of it is hidden. For example, the Pasuk doesn't tell us that Ahasuerus was having a political war trying to establish his kingdom. Or does it? The Pasuk begins by discussing Ahasuerus HaMelech, Vashti HaMalka Vashti. It proceeds with the word Melech and then the person's name, meaning Vashti, she had a right to the throne. She was HaMalka Vashti. And Ahasuerus keeps stressing, he tells her, you're Vashti HaMalka. You're Vashti, my beloved, and because of me, you're queen. And Vashti maintained, and everyone else maintained, that she had a right to the throne because she was Nebuchadnezzar's granddaughter. And this was the next monarchy. This was the Persian Empire. So Ahasuerus keeps stressing, you're only queen by my virtue. So that's hidden. The Megillah keeps stressing which word comes first, the person's name or the fact that they're king. If the fact that they're king comes first, so that's what they're claiming. I have a right to the throne. What's Ahasuerus telling her? I want to show everyone your beauty. Why is that so important? He wants to say, I only took her as my wife because she's beautiful, not because I needed a right to the throne.
Right, but we also say that this is the majority that say that it will be full of...
Okay, that's another midrash, right? There are a lot of midrashim.
So how can we get one midrash that says that and we understand that she's pretty?
Well, she began being very pretty. And then God made it that that night she didn't look so pretty. And now we're ready to begin the Megillah. It was in these times of Ahasuerus, the wicked Ahasuerus, who ruled over the world and held a very, very tight reign over the world. He ruled over 127 cities because God wanted Esther, who would be queen, to have rulership over 127 cities because she was an offspring of Sarah, who lived 127 years. And when Ahasuerus finally established this great throne that looked like King Solomon's throne, and he figured that the years were up, that the Jews would never again be redeemed, he threw a party. Now, if we recall, Nebuchadnezzar's initial plot was get the Jews to sin. If they sin by bowing to my idol, then God will never want them again, and they will not, that prophecy, that dream that he saw, will never come true. The Jews will not have their Messiah. And now Ahasuerus figures the same thing. He says, I'll throw a party, I'll make it kosher, I'll invite the Jews, and maybe God will forsake them. And it almost came true. He serves everyone with exceptional vessels. The Torah says, the Megillah says, V'chelim mikelim shonim, vessels that were either unusual, and this is one of the words that are read in the tune of Lamentations of Eicha, to stress that we're mourning. He took out the vessels of the Beis HaMikdash, and everyone looked at those vessels and they said everything else looks like earthenware compared to these beautiful vessels. And the Jews were there as well. Mordechai had told them don't go to the party, but they didn't listen. A heavenly voice came out and said, Kelim Shonim. Shonim also means repeat, like Shnaim. When your grandfather, your predecessor, not your grandfather, when Belshazzar took out these vessels, you know a heavenly hand came out and wrote on the wall, and that night is when his whole kingdom was destroyed. That's when the Persian Mede Empire came to power. And now you're taking those vessels and using them again? Heavenly voice said, you're Shonim, you're using them again. And they gave out a lot of wine. Now, ordinarily, they'd have this big goblet and you'd have to finish it, whether you liked it or not. But tonight, Ahasuerus said, in this party, everyone drinks as much as they want. We're not forcing anyone. We're going to bring wine from every country so that every person feels comfortable. They're drinking the wine they're used to. And every person has to say their age at the party, and we give them a wine that's older than them. So Ahasuerus is showing his splendor, his wealth. Vashti, she makes her party for women. Again, as we discussed earlier, she has a plot, she and Ahasuerus, that they'll have mixed dancing in the middle. Whenever I come to weddings, that that are separate, I'm happy. And sometimes I'm witness to something that's very sad. The wedding begins separate, and then at some point during the wedding, someone starts removing the mechitza, and then it becomes mixed. So when I see this, I'm reminded of this. That was their plan. That's what Vashti and Achashverosh were thinking. We'll get everyone enjoying our feast, and then on the seventh day, we'll get everyone to mix. Now, Mordechai is praying until the seventh day, until Shabbos. He spent the first 6 days fasting, and when he and his Sanhedrin have been praying for 6 days now, up to the seventh day, that the heavenly court shouldn't get upset at the Jewish people for what they're doing, so to an extent their prayer has been accepted, so that when Achashverosh is fully drunk, he tells his men, Mehuman, Bizta, Harvona, Bigta, Avakta, Zetar, Harkas, his seven eunuchs, he tells them, I want you to go and bring my wife Vashti, tell her to come with the crown. Going with that understanding, he's saying, she doesn't really deserve the crown. I have to remind her to wear the crown. He's pointing out, he's telling them in front of everyone, tell her to bring the crown with her, as if stressing, I didn't marry her because she comes from aristocracy. I have to tell her to wear the crown. If I wouldn't tell her, remember to don that crown, then she might show up without the crown. She only wears the crown by virtue of me. Now, Achashverosh has this chip on his shoulder. He didn't come from royal blood. And he gained the throne only because of his wealth. He had a lot of money, and he had worked his way up. Initially, he was the stable boy in Belshazzar's stable. And now he keeps trying to make his kingdom solidified. And that's why he moves the capital from where it had been in Babylon, and he moves it into Shushan. He's the one that institutes Shushan as the capital. He tells them, bring Vashti, the queen, notice again, Vashti the queen, naked, and this was decreed in heaven, that she would make Jewish girls work naked on Shabbos. So it was decreed in heaven that that's how she would be brought, and tell her to wear only the crown. Why? Why did she merit to come with the crown? Because Nebuchadnezzar, her grandfather, had given Daniel royal clothing. And I want to show the nations how beautiful she is. Now here there's a very interesting medrash. The medrash says when Jews get together on Shabbos and they eat and drink, what do? They say Divrei Torah and they sing praise to Hashem. This is one of the sources that I know of that we're supposed to sing Zmiros on Shabbos. Where does it come from? We sing Zmiros. The idea is, you say Divrei Torah, and you sing Zmiros. What are the Zmiros? We praise Hashem. That's the idea of the Zmiros. When people who don't have the Torah get together, and they eat and drink, so what do? They start talking about women. So that's what happened. They're sitting at the party, and they start talking about people from different nationalities, from different nations. Each one starts talking about how beautiful the women in their nation is. And as they're talking, Achashverosh says, I got the most beautiful of them all. I'm telling you, my girl, she's not a Persian, she's not a Mede, she's not from this nation, not from that. She's a special girl from the Kastin. She comes from those special branch. So they say, and she's better than all the others? He says, yeah. He says, I'll show you. They say, show us. So he says, I'll show you. He's drunk, they're drunk. What are you doing? You're drunk. Talk about women. I hope it's not what you do, but that's what Achashverosh and all the guys there are doing. So I often think about this when people are sitting at a table and the conversation doesn't go the way a Jewish conversation should go. So I say, so hey, the Medrash says that by a Jewish table that's not the way a conversation should go. By us, if we're eating and drinking, so what's supposed to come out is the praise of Hashem. That's why on Purim we get drunk. We're showing that Chayav Inish Lebesume, a person on Purim has to put on perfume. What does it mean to put on perfume? That's a nickname for getting drunk. When a Jew gets drunk, it's supposed to be like perfume. It's supposed to be that everyone looks at him and says, wow, look at what's coming out of him. So I'm not on a level where I think that's what would happen if I get drunk, so I don't get drunk. I'm happy to hear there are a lot of tzaddikim around here who are. I'm scared that if I get drunk, maybe I won't bench after I eat. And that's a biblical commandment. Yeah. Rav Kook happened to write that when he was very, very young. And he's coming to rule not on that point. He's coming to rule on the question of if a person is drinking wine to fulfill the mitzvah of drinking wine on Purim. And as a result of that, he will not be able to dam mincha later. He's not talking about a person transgressing, causing a chil Hashem, walking in the street and throwing up on people, walking in the street and yelling at people. He's not talking about the other things that I unfortunately have seen going on around there. He's not talking about damaging a friend's object, which also, you're not allowed to damage someone's object. So there are certain leniencies in Purim, but that doesn't mean that you could have a heyday. I don't know. We could look it up, but I don't remember. No, I don't remember the exact logic there.
He was referring to mincha in that context.
Rav Kook wrote it about mincha. Right. I don't know if he would say it about the biblical obligation of benching. I don't remember. We have to look it up. I don't remember his logic, so I don't know if it would make a difference. I don't remember. He's dealing with the sugya tchilato b'pshiyav sofo b'onis. You're starting off, you know you're going to end up. There's a sugya in the Gemara. When you start doing something, you're putting yourself into a situation where you're going to end up being anus, forced to transgress something. So, are you allowed to do that? That's what he's working off of. I don't know how he'd apply to binging. I don't know. Savashti refuses. She is not willing to listen to what he says, and he's upset. Why does Vashti refuse? So we discussed the different midrashim, whether God sent the satan to dance between them to cause a rift, because of everything she had done and he had done, he stopped building the Beis HaMikdash. According to one Medrash, she's the one that advised him to stop building the Beis HaMikdash. According to another Medrash, she would torture the Jewish girls, but she hated the Jews in the way her father and grandfather had, assuming she came from Belshazzar. And so the king goes to the tribe of Yisachar, who are known for their wisdom. They're the ones who know how to figure out the calendar, and he knows they know the Torah, and they're not drunk. And he comes to them and he asks them, what should I do? And they say, you know, this is a din of dinei nefashos. Here we have to rule whether she deserves to be killed or not. And once we've been exiled, we don't have the ability to rule on questions of that pertains to taking someone's life. We don't have that ability in Chutz Laaretz now. Yeah?
When can we stop knowing who is
Tenshvat? I don't know.
This is after the destruction of the first 7 years left in the first temple.
Right. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
Hundreds of years after.
So I don't know. So they pray to Hashem and they say, We don't know how to answer you. And so the king asks his advisors who are supposed to figure out, according to what she did and the scenario, I mean, in front of everyone, what should we do to her? And the seven advisors, they're the ones who are closest to him. Memuchan jumps before the rest, and he says, you know what? What she did is a nationalistic offense. She's hurt everyone. Memuchan had serious issues with his wife. She was always telling him what to do. So he figures he'll pounce on the opportunity to try to enforce his position in the home, which might sound funny to you, but after you're married, it won't sound so funny. Why do I say that? Because in most cases, the wife runs the home. So in Judaism, we say, yeah, there's Sar HaPnim and Sar HaChutz. There's the one who's responsible for the inside and the one who's responsible for the outside. The woman, she is responsible for the home. She's a Keret HaBayit. She's the main one of the home. So if the wife says, don't put that milk cup on the halachic table. So if the husband wants to show off, he'll say, well, logically it's cold, it's this, it's that. And if he wants to respect his wife's reign over the house, he'll say, I'm sorry, honey, sure, just a second. He learns how she wants him to put it down on the table. The fact that he could say, logically maybe it's not necessary, okay, but she's the one running the home. But if a person walks into marriage thinking, what I say goes, and unfortunately a lot of people do, then he's usually in for a rude awakening. And he could spend his whole life trying to change, to turn the tables. So Memuchan has a problem with his wife. She's down his back. In Judaism we say, honor her like a queen, and she'll honor you like a king. But you have to begin by honoring her like a queen. But Memuchan had this ongoing fight with her, and she said, "You talk my dialect. We're going to talk my language." And he wanted to refuse, but he wasn't getting very far. Yeah.
Two things. One, don't we have
Medrash
that says that
Memuchan
and Daniel?
There is such a
Medrash,
yeah.
And two, wasn't
that Medrash says that Daniel also had a problem with his wife, that she wanted him to talk a different language. So I don't know what to do with that Medrash, but Tosfos quotes the Medrash that Daniel had an issue with his wife, that she kept forcing him to talk another language. What the Medrash means, I don't know.
Okay. And number two, wasn't Memuchan
Yeah. So when Medrash keeps talking about Sarisim, eunuchs, so there are two understandings as to whether it means literally or it's a borrowed term for all servants of the king. It is possible that Daniel was castrated. Yeah. Daniel is going to be referred to as Hasoch later on, and this is either because he is Hasoch from the word Chotech, cut. Either he was cut off of the position of power that he had until Achashverosh's reign, or else he was the one who gave the advice upon which all decrees were cut. He was the top advisor. Two understandings as to what Daniel's position is at this period, at this point in time. That one I never heard. I was thinking that would be an interesting one, but it doesn't say that. Maybe it says I didn't see it. So Memuchan says, if word's going to get out, so all the women are going to say, look, if she got away with it, I could get away with it too. So if it finds favor in your eyes, we have to send out a letter saying that this is what was done to Vashti because she wouldn't come to the king. Her kingdom will be given to someone else. Now, Haman had a daughter who he had in mind that Ahasuerus should marry. So when Haman says this, he's hoping, I'll get rid of Vashti and my daughter will get in, and then I'll end up getting the throne. So Ahasuerus listens to him. He's been drunk, and he does what he advised him, and he sends letters throughout the land saying every person, every man runs the show in the house, and you speak his language. And it was thanks to this letter that the Jews were saved. Our Megillah, one of the things that it's showing us is that Kadosh Baruch Hu makdim refuah lamakah, that before God hits the Jewish people, he always has the remedy prepared. And so the first two chapters are telling us how God prepares the remedy. The first part of the remedy is that the nations should all tell themselves, God, this man is nuts. We can't trust anything he says. This Ahasuerus is absolutely crazy. So after they get such a letter, they say, well, he's telling me what language I should talk in my home. Why? What's interfering between me and my wife? He's going to tell me who's boss in my house. So they said, must be he's a fool. After they heard that, they said, okay, if he tells us a decree that we could kill every Jew in our state on the 13th of Adar, we better wait and make sure he didn't change his mind, because this guy's just stupid. And they were proven right, because a short while later, he changed his mind. 5 days later, he says, forget it. He kills Haman. And then a month and a half later, he sends out a new decree, every Jew could kill his enemy. So the people, the reason they waited and didn't start their pogroms when the first letter came from Ahasuerus was because of this story with Vashti. So after this story, Ahasuerus has become sober, and he's calmed down from his anger. So he starts remembering Vashti, and his people told him, "You're the one who decided to kill her for what she did." So he says, "I didn't say she should get killed. I said she should come and she didn't come. I said you should remove the kingdom from her. I ever said she should get killed?" So they say, no, you decreed she should get killed. You asked your 7 advisors. So he got very upset. And according to this Medrash, I guess Memuchan wasn't Haman, he hung those 7 advisors. So this Medrash is going that Memuchan was not Haman. Either if it was, then obviously he didn't hang them. So now he has new young advisors. And they tell him, look, we'll get you a good-looking virgin and send word to everyone that all of your top advisors, they for sure know all the good-looking girls in their locale, and they'll help you collect the good-looking girls. You'll find a new wife. So here the story introduces us to Mordechai. And Mordechai is called Ish Yehudi. He was the one man who was a Yehudi, who was a person who believed in one God, Yehudi, stems from God's name, Yud-Kei-Vav-Kei, one who does not serve idols, that was Mordechai. And he's called Mordechai because he was compared to the sense, the spice in the Ktores, that's called Mordiror, and that's translated in Aramaic to Mera Dachya. So that's why it's called Mordechai. This is an important point, because the researchers like to say Mordechai comes from the word Marduk, which was a Persian god. And our sages also questioned, where do we encounter such a name, Mordechai? The Gemara asks, where does Mordechai come from? Where do we get this name from? So the Gemara says it comes from the word pure mor. And mor is a type of spice. That's why Mordechai was known as Mordechai. And he's 10 generations from Shaul. He comes from the tribe of Benjamin. And he's the one that came because David, King David, did not kill Al-Shimi ben Gera. So Mordechai has exiled of his own volition to join the Jews out in Persia, and he adopts his niece Hadassah. Now Hadassah is given the nickname Esther. Esther is not her real name. Esther comes from the word Estahar, which means in Persian the moon, because Esther was so beautiful, so all the people around gave her this nickname, the one who's beautiful like the moon. That's why she got the name Esther. But her real name is Hadassah. Yeah. Esther is not a Jewish name. Esther is, comes from a Greek, from a Persian name. Yeah.
I've heard that Esther's skin is slightly tinged green.
We'll get to that. Yeah. We'll get to that. So, his brother passes away just after he impregnates his wife. And then his sister-in-law passes away a childbirth. So Esther is born a total orphan. She has no father and no mother. And Mordechai adopts her, and he takes her as a wife. Now, she's called Hadassah because Hadass in Hebrew is, we know the bush of Hadass. Hadass always represents tzaddikim. When someone is called Hadassah, it means the one who is like a tzaddik. When Zechariah, the prophet Zechariah, sees the angel of God standing on a red horse between the hadassim, between the myrtle branches, he is referring to between the tzaddikim. This angel is standing among tzaddikim. In Hebrew, hadass is representative of a tzaddik. So Esther says, though she would be called tzaddik. You know, there's a name for boys, tzaddik. So for a girl, it's hadassah. And they called her Esther because she was always hidden. For 75 years, no one saw her. No man saw her. She was a modest girl living by Mordechai. And according to this medrash, this puts Esther at 75 years old. And you ask yourself, what's a guy like Ahasuerus looking for a girl like this? But obviously, she was very beautiful. So our sages say that her skin was yirakrok, had a greenish tinge, like a hadas, like a myrtle branch. So she wasn't very good looking, but God surrounded her with a chut shel chesed. God made her have chayim. People liked her. So he adopts her, and if we read the plain words of the Medrash, of the Megillah calls her a Na'ara, which seems to put her at 12. Everything else is Midrashim. The Megillah seems to put her at 12 years old, and she seems to be an adopted daughter of Mordechai. And the Megillah says she was Yifat Tov, Tovat Mareh, she had every good look that could be, and Mordechai has adopted her. And yeah.
Is there a connection between this and I heard some they make a connection between Eshet Yifat Tovar when they go into war, the woman like an Eshet Yifat Tovar. I can't remember.
I don't know.
It's also refers to Yiska Masa,
I don't know. No, I'm not saying it's wrong. I don't know. I'll be happy to see it, but I don't know. So when all the girls are gathered to Haggai, the head of the harem, so Esther goes into hiding, but they've heard about this good-looking girl living in Mordechai's home, so they come, they search his home, they find her, and she's taken in. And when she's taken in, Mordechai said, it can't be that such a thing would happen to such a tzaddikes unless God has a hidden plan. And that's why Mordechai is going day by day to see what's happening, because he wants to see what's God's plan here. And this is an important attitude in Judaism. Very often a person has to live through difficult circumstances. And to quote, Rav Herschel Schachter quoted someone who said this, every year has its catastrophe. In life, you have to be prepared. Every year has its brach, something difficult to deal with. In life, that's life. Life isn't a pile of roses. Life is what we make of it. But we have to be prepared for difficulties. There's no such thing as an easy year in life. So when Mordechai sees that she's taken in, so every day he's waiting to see, what does God have in mind? And that's an important attitude. Sometimes a person has to be able to take a step back and say, wait a second, what's going on here? What does God have in store for me? When I came to the army, so I had to work out my papers with him. So they tell me, okay, well, we'll deal with you, no problem. Go sit down downstairs by this in this office. So I said, okay, but did we finish what we have to do? He said, yeah, they'll give you the form you need and you could go home. So I said, okay. So I go, I'm sitting there. After 15 minutes, I go up to a girl there and I say, can I go yet? Do you want to mail me the form? She says, what do you mean go? We're not done with you. I said, yeah, but I understood you just gave me a form which you're anyways going to mail to me. Do I have to wait for it? She said, I don't know what you're talking about. We're getting the van ready. We're taking you to prison. And I don't know where you want to go, but you better not set foot out of here or else I'll tell those soldiers to go catch you. So I said, what are you taking me to prison for? What did I do? They said, what do you mean what you do? You know exactly what you did. I said, I think you got a mistake. She said, you just wait right there. We're taking care of you. So I'm asking myself, okay, maybe they tricked me upstairs. Like, they told me I'm on my way out. I thought I was finished. And I remembered this. I said to myself, this is going to be interesting. I was there just to fill out the forms. I came from Chutzaritz. I was here. So I needed to show up to the army, tell them I'm here, and work out just the details of my stay. And she said, she started yelling, she said, we know you ran away, you were supposed to show up and enlist, and you didn't, and after you spent months in hiding, now you show up, don't worry, we're going to take good care of you. I said, look, if you don't mind, maybe I'll just run upstairs and make sure that there isn't a mix-up. So she said, you're not leaving here. I said, okay. I said, when is the van coming? She said, you have a few hours, sit, enjoy the time. So I said, okay, if I have a few hours, do you mind when you have 3 seconds, just call, make sure, because I don't think you got the right guy. They told me I'm coming down here for form X, Y, and Z. And thank God, after a little bit of pleading, she agreed to call. And it turns out that they weren't throwing me into prison for who knows how long. But I remember sitting there and asking myself, this is interesting. what does God have in mind for me? No, I was married a few years, and I said to myself, you know what? What's the worst thing? I hope they let me take a safer into there. I'll get some serious learning done. You know, it's not going to be pleasant, but I didn't do anything wrong. You know, okay, so no one's going to talk to me for who knows how long and whatever. I said, you know, maybe this is a good plan. I don't know. I mean, if this is what God had in mind for me, I did my best. We'll see. But I remember thinking of this, that Mordechai said, if this is where she's thrown into this harem, for 12 months she's going to be just busy beautifying herself for this miserable king. It must be God has something in mind. So who knows what he has in mind? Let's see. And day by day, Mordechai kept coming to visit her. He's on the lookout. He's giving her moral support and checking what's going to happen with her. What's going to happen in the end? And that's an important attitude in life. Sometimes we have to say, it's out of my control. There's nothing I could do. So I don't mean to say, let's sit back and enjoy the show, but I'll do my best in this show, and let's see what God has in mind. What's going to happen here? I'll do my best. I'm not saying we should not do our best, but what is going to happen? So Mordechai is coming back day after day to see what's going to happen. And Esther finds favor in the eyes of the head of the harem. And it doesn't say it, but it seems to me to be obvious that Esther treated him like mensch. You don't like someone if he treats you like dirt. And this is something which we find often, that our great leaders, even when they dealt with people who were not the most positive people, this guy is the head of the harem. He's probably not the nicest person in the world. His job is dealing with women all day long. Maybe it's not his fault, but I'm sure Esther didn't want to have much dealings with him. And nonetheless, Esther was a mensch. She behaved, okay, this is a person. People very often scoff at the doorman or not even tell him good morning, and that's not what we see from our great leaders. Our great rabbis always treated everyone humanely. when Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky passed away, it's known that his yeshiva was right next to a monastery. So the girls from the monastery, after a few weeks, they asked one of the rabbis, "Hey, where's that nice old man?" So he said, "He passed away. How did you know about him?" So they said, "Well, every time he'd walk by here, he'd tell us good morning nicely." So all the students, they see all these nuns, they want to keep as far away from them as they could. But Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky, when he would walk by, he would tell them good morning and keep walking. So this is what we see all the time, that our great leaders treat people nicely. Even a person like Haggai ends up looking at Esther and saying, "Wait, she's a good girl, let me help her out." So he brings her everything he can, and he brings her the seven girls that will help her. Now, being stuck secluded from the world in this harem, so she can't keep track of the days. So she names her servants, the servants that she's granted, she gives each one a name that corresponds to the dates. The one of Sunday, she gave him a name, Rokeita. You're like the sun, like the heavens, which reminded her that on the first day God created the heavens and the earth, so she knows it's Sunday. And the second one, she called him Genuneta. The third one, she called him Nehorita, the sun that was created on the third day. The fourth day, Rochashita, that's the creepy crawly creatures. The fifth day, Chulfita, I don't know what that is. The sixth day, Regoita, calmness, and on Shabbos, calmness was for Shabbos. So they were all tzaddikim. These were seven servants who were going to stand by her side and help her out. So he ensured to give her all the good food. The Gemara says he brought her special pigs, parts of a pig, kadlei chazireh, which is supposed to be the best part of a pig. And here there's an interesting machlokas Rashi and Tosis. Rashi says she didn't have a choice. This is the food they're giving her. This is what she ate, and God didn't punish her because she was stuck in this harem. She had nothing else to eat. This is what he's giving her. He wants to honor her, so he brings her the special parts of a pig. Tosis says, God forbid that she ate it. He brought it to her, but she managed to get something else to eat. She wouldn't eat that. And there's another understanding that's interesting. The Aruch, who was a predecessor to Rashi, Rabbi Natan, who compiled the encyclopedia called the Aruch, so he says it doesn't mean chaziri is fish. Chaziri is like chazeret that we eat on Pesach. It's a type of a lettuce. So he brought her this extra special lettuce. That's what she was eating over there. But we have the simple understanding of the Gemara of Rashi that she's eating pig. As she's in this harem, she's eating pig, but she has no choice. That's the food that she's given. And Haggai means well. He wants to give her extra special food. Now, Mordechai tells her, don't tell anyone what family you're from. Because Mordechai says, you know why Vashti got into trouble? Because Vashti said, I'm from an important family. I come from aristocracy. You keep quiet about your family. He wants Esther to keep a low profile. Esther also comes from an important family. She comes from the kings of the Jews. So Mordechai tells Esther to keep quiet about where she comes from. So now Haggai doesn't know where she's from. No one around her knows where she's from. Again, hidden. The whole book of Esther, hidden. Yeah.
Why isn't she telling anybody that she was at least married? You think that would like kind of...
It didn't interest them. Ahasuerus took married women too. Anyone that was good looking.
Okay.
Mordechai was concerned if Ahasuerus gets upset at her, he'll wipe out all of the Jews. So I don't know. Vashti didn't fare too well. Best is she doesn't tell him what people she's from either.
So, is she going in there under the suspicion that she's single or that she's married?
Well, I don't know. I don't know if she was going in...
Because if she thinks that she's single, the first night that she spends with the king, he'd find out...
No, he knew he wasn't getting only virgins. He knew that.
Okay.
So every day Mordechai would come to the gates, praying and trying to find out how Esther's doing. And this is something that Ger Rebbe has a beautiful pshat here. He says, why did Mordechai merit to have the whole redemption of the Jewish people on his shoulders? Because Mordechai came every single day to see how Esther was doing. When people have a wife who just gave birth or a relative in the hospital, they come and they visit, but they don't visit every day. So a wife in the hospital, hopefully you visit every day and more than once a day. She's only there here in Israel for a total of 2 days, so if you can, you visit her as often as possible. But when we're talking about at least a year that she's there, to come every single day, that's exceptional. people can have perseverance for a month, but for a year or 2 years or 4 years, that's already very, very difficult. And the fact that Mordechai ensured that every day she got word, he's looking out for her, he's checking how she's doing, that's very important. And in life, you're going to see, sometimes it's a relative that's in jail, sometimes it's a relative that's in the hospital. It's very tempting to say, you know, I got to go on with my life. They'll manage. I visited them here, I visited them there, I'll visit them again. I feel that if a person can, he should call his parents every day. I'm not talking about a situation where the parents bring a person down and they keep telling them, don't learn, and a person can't. They're going to ruin his life. But if it's a normal situation where there's a normal relationship, so when I was in the U.S., I'd call my parents every day. Even if it just meant leaving them a message every day. Hi, I hope everything is well, I'm doing okay, have a good day. And when I was in the U.S., I'd call twice a day, in the morning and at night. So I didn't have long conversations. They weren't home most of the time when I called. But I called every day. I think it's part of what we owe our parents, and it's part of what we owe a relative or someone we know who we could help. It's interesting that the rabbis, one of the responsibilities of the rabbis used to be to visit their congregants in the hospital. Rabbi Feinstein, I saw many times, get on a bus and travel to the hospital to visit a congregant who was ill. That was one of the responsibilities of the rabbi. Rabbi Akiva Eiger, the great sage of Europe, that when he married... He lost his first wife, and then they told him maybe he should marry the Chassam Sofer's daughter. So he said, no, the Chassam Sofer would want someone greater than me. He has Chassam Sofer's daughter. I can't marry Chassam Sofer's daughter. They went to the Chassam Sofer and they said, why doesn't your daughter marry, why don't we set her up with Rabbi Akiva Eiger? So he said, Rabbi Akiva Eiger, my daughter? You're kidding? He's going to need someone, he needs a great person's daughter. He's not going to be willing to go out with my daughter. So Rabbi Akiva Eiger said, I'm an Amoritz next to Chassam Sofer. I can't go out with his daughter. And the Chassam Sofer said, I'm an Amoritz next to Rabbi Akiva Eiger. He's not going to go out with my daughter. So the Shatran said, fine. He says he's an Amoritz. You say you're an Amoritz. So let the Amoritz date the Amoritz's daughter and everything will be okay. And he married her. He married her. The Sofer dynasty continued that way. Rabbi Akiva Eiger marrying his daughter. But Rabbi Akiva Eiger at a young age was the chief rabbi of Europe, basically. Everyone knew him, and he was very, very, very modest. Very modest. You see it in his letters. His sons, in the beginning of his responsa, they write that he told them, when you quote my responsa, when you write up my responsa, if you ever see that it says to my student, you should know that someone who copied my letter added that in so that we know who the letter was written to. Because never in my life did I call anyone a student, because I never know who taught whom more. We learn together. Sometimes they say something, sometimes I say something. So I don't know who taught whom more. So I never called anyone in my life a student. So I don't never print in my name that I wrote to anyone my student, because I never in my life called anyone a student. And this is someone who at a young age was considered the top rabbi of Europe, Rabbi Akiva Eiger. So he was very, very modest. And he'd begin every day going to the hospital. He said, after I go to the hospital, then I could say the morning blessings of appreciation, that I could see, that I could walk, that I could stand. After I visit my congregants, the people who are ill, then I could go to prayer. Yeah?
Yeah.
Not the Marsha you're thinking of. There is a Rav Shlomo Eiger, who is Rabbi Akiva Eger's son. And the Gilyon Marsha in the Shulchan Aruch, that's Rav Shlomo Eiger, that's Rabbi Akiva Eiger's son. The Marsha in the back of the Gemara is a different Marsha, if I'm not mistaken. I don't think so. In the Marsha, his mother-in-law was a wealthy woman. He adopted her last name. I don't remember the last name, but it wasn't his last name. He adopted his mother-in-law's last name, which was common. Now, Deret also did that. He took Rav Kook's last name because he was his father-in-law. This was common when you had an important father-in-law or mother-in-law. So the Marsha's mother-in-law was a wealthy woman who funded his kollel. So he adopted her last name. So it served him better. Back to the Megillah. So every day Mordechai comes to check how Esther's doing. And every girl that's brought has spent 6 months with the oil, removing their hairs and making their skin soft and smelly. And they're brought before the king. And when the 12 months are up, that's when she's ready. And she gets whatever she wants. And Esther doesn't want anything because she's not looking to entice him into marrying her. Esther's turn comes. And Haggai insists on sending some things with her. And wherever Esther goes, everyone says, boy, that's a good looking girl. As she's on her way to the king, everyone says, wow. Now don't forget, this girl had a greenish tinge to her. She wasn't looking too good. And she was 75 or older. But God wanted her as queen. So Esther is brought before Ahasuerus, and he brings her into his castle in the 10th month, the month of Teves. This is the 7th year of his reign. So 4 years have passed since Vashti's been killed. And our sages teach us that God purposely made it the month of Teves when it's cold, and people like body warmth more. So we see that in heavens they were setting everything up so that she'll find favor in his eyes. And he likes Esther better than all the married women he had seen and all the non-married women he had seen. And he takes Esther and he gives her the crown, and he removes the statue of Vashti from his palace, and he establishes the picture, the statue of Esther in her place, and he gives her... Yeah. So until then, he kept thinking of Vashti's beauty. And he establishes Esther on the throne, and she is queen instead of Vashti. You may... Yeah.
When you said that it was Teves, what did you mean that like they appreciated body warmth?
When it's a cold month, so people appreciate being in bed with someone with more heat, being close to someone, more than a warm month. In the summer, people like take off the covers, and in the winter, they put on more covers. He makes a big party for all his servants. He calls it the party in honor of Esther. And he gives a reduction in taxes. And he sends out gifts, everything in honor of Esther. And Mordechai is davening. He's hoping things will work out for Esther. And Esther has a problem. Esther is really Mordechai's wife. How come Esther is willing to go with someone else? The halacha is that a person is supposed to give up their life to not commit adultery. So our sages say that this only applies to a man. A woman, when someone else is having relations with her, she is considered kalka olam, like the earth on the ground. She's not active, she's not doing anything. And being that something is being done to her, she's like, she's just lying there. So she does not have to give up her life rather than commit adultery. Meaning if someone's threatening her with a life, if she's going to protest against Ahasuerus, she'll kill her. So she doesn't have to give up her life because she's not active. She doesn't do anything. And that's why Esther may be in that situation. She doesn't have to give up her life even though she's Mordechai's wife. And when Esther would finish with Ahasuerus, she'd go to mikveh. She'd clean herself. Not because she halachically has to go to mikveh, but because it's disgusting for Mordechai to be with his wife after she'd been with Ahasuerus. And then she'd go and lie by Mordechai. And here, Tosfos asks a question. How could it be that Esther is living with two men, Ahasuerus and Mordechai? So halachically, she doesn't have to give up her life rather than live with Ahasuerus. Right, she's not doing anything, she's not active. But at the end of the day, we have a halacha that says that when a woman loses one husband, she has to wait 3 months before she remarries, because we need to discern, is that child from the first husband or from the second husband? A woman has to wait, because we need to know who, from where that child comes. We don't want him to end up marrying his sister or whatever. Yeah.
Did Ahasuerus have other children? Did he have any children?
I don't know of a record that he had other children, but that would make sense that he did. If he's living with 4 years with 365 wives a year, it makes sense he has children.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What? When did the halakha waiting 3 months come into effect?
I don't know. Tosa seems to assume that it was true in this time already. So Tosfos gives us an answer. The Mishnah discusses nashim shemeshamshot b'moch, women who could have relations with their husband and at the same time they have some kind of tampon that absorbs and prevents the seed from entering the woman so she can't get pregnant, some kind of birth control. So ordinarily that's a problem halachically, but let's say a woman, if she gets pregnant, there are times that the doctors say she'll die. She can't get pregnant. There are situations where a woman has reasons where she cannot get pregnant, and the halacha says she may use birth control. So Tosa says that Esther was using birth control. She had a moch. She had some kind of shmata that she stuck inside, so that she couldn't get pregnant. This was a way of blocking it. Now, Tosus doesn't say if she used the moch when she was with Ahasuerus or with Mordechai. Who was she using it with? Because at some point she did get pregnant from Ahasuerus. So we know that later on, when she goes to Ahasuerus, she says, "I will never be able to be with you again, Mordechai." When she has to go and initiate the time with Ahasuerus, when Mordechai tells her the Jews are at risk, all of the Jewish people will be annihilated if you don't walk in, she says, "Fine, but then this time I'm going of my own volition. We will never again be able to be together as husband and wife. That's it, our relationship is over. I don't have a choice." She's one of the prophetesses, and she has prophecy. At that point, so I guess then she got pregnant. That's when she had Darius, Daryavish, who was a Jew, but he was her son from Ahasuerus. So this Tosus is very important, because this Tosus is one of the sources based upon which we have the discussions of birth control. When do we permit it in halacha? This is one of the sources. So it's a Mishnah, it's a Gemara, and here we have this Tosus that discusses here how Esther did that. Ahasuerus tries to get Esther to reveal what nationality she's from, and Mordechai keeps supporting her and telling her, don't tell, and she does not. Whatever Mordechai says, she's still listening. Mordechai tells her when Shabbos, she keeps Shabbos. He fills her in when the courts decided it's Yom Tov, it's Rosh Chodesh, she keeps the law of the Yom Tov and Rosh Chodesh. When she was a Nida, so she distanced herself. She wouldn't eat from the things that were cooked by non-Jews, nor would she drink the wine of non-Jews, as the halacha forbids. What? How'd she do all this? So she had a whole network set up with her servants, with Daniel, with Mordechai. She ensured that she only ate kosher food. It seems like the seven girls who were with her were, the Medrash says they were tzaddikim, so it seems they might have been Jewish. Mordechai is in the Sanhedrin, and Esther establishes his Sanhedrin at the gates, the entrance to the king's palace. And when the other politicians see that this happens, they start getting jealous. And they're upset. They say, it must be that Esther is going to advise the king to remove us from our position and establish Mordechai instead. So we don't have a choice. We have to bump them off. And Bigson and Seresh, some of the top politicians, they're in charge of top places in the palace. They decide that they're going to give Esther poison to drink, and they'll murder Ahasuerus with a sword while he's sleeping. And Mordechai finds out, because he knew the 70 languages, so he warns Esther. And Esther tells the king in the name of Mordechai, and when they check it out, they take the drink and they give it to the dog to drink, and the dog drops dead. They realize that these people really didn't want to poison Esther, and they hang these two, Bigson and Seresh, and this is written in the king's diary. The diary which the king would have read frequently before him. They want to poison Esther and assassinate Ahasuerus. They want to bump them both off. Yeah. This isn't Rashi, you're right. This is the Targum. Yeah.
Why didn't Mordechai tell anybody that they're trying to murder Ahasuerus?
So we mentioned last night that this shows us that sometimes, not sometimes, often we find that our sages taught us to be loyal to the current kingdom. Which was he transgressing? Because he took married women, saying that was his transgression. I don't know. The Mishnah says it's palel bishloma shel malchut, pray for the peacefulness of the kingdom. So the commentaries point out that if this was a righteous kingdom, the Mishnah wouldn't have to teach us that we should pray for their success. When the Mishnah tells us it palel bishloma shel malchut, pray for the peace of the kingdom, that the authority should maintain their authority, the Mishnah is teaching us even an authority that seems to be problematic. They're not doing things nicely.
So it's like you are in Iran, living in Iran, and Ahmad comes before you to make a bracha?
the bracha is a separate question. I think you would definitely have to make a bracha on him, because he is a king and he could kill someone. He could kill at random. He has that power. President Bush can. I'm not sure if you make a blessing on President Bush. I don't know. But the president of Iran could kill whoever he wants. I don't know if the president Bush make a blessing. Yeah.
You brought up last night about the Jews during World War II in Russia, whether they should pray for Russia, but you never actually said what.
There were two different opinions. There was a machlokas between Chabad and the other rabbis, who we should pray for, the Tsar or the opposing forces. And during the rebellion also, the rabbis asked, who should we be loyal to? We have to be loyal to the authorities. Who's the authorities? Who do we have to show loyalty to?
Which one was Chabad say?
I don't remember, but you could find that.
They put the spies to Napoleon.
I don't know.
Because the Alfred was living in Miyazi, right? So when Napoleon came and he wasn't loyal, he was loyal to Russia. They made him leave. They kicked him out.
Could be, I don't know the details of the story.
They had the Shita that they say that the Lord emphasized it, that the Tsar was trying to destroy the Jews physically and Napoleon spiritually. So Chabad took a stand to
be with the Tsar. Okay.
I don't know if it's anywhere else in the Shagar, but I know that the wizards is like in Pirkei Avot, right? That it says, like, pray to God for the government, for the amount of people and killing for their lives. It sounds like, at least to me, I would sound like it's saying, pray for the government, because even if it's an evil government, it's the only thing that's ensuring at least some semblance of civil, safety. So then, wouldn't it follow, though, that if the government is being threatened by another government, that'll be more righteous? I guess if it's being threatened by a public anarchy, then if the king of Persia, right? Is being, threatened by a possible revolution and wants to put in a good guy. Would a Jewish happen to Iran have to pray for him or them? Because
I don't know. In all these questions, you need someone who knows a lot. I don't know. Yeah, I don't know. We begin Achar Hadvarim Ha'ela, after these things. And again, the Megillah is stressing, after God has established the cure that always precedes the Makkah that God gives the Jewish people. There's always Refuah Kodem LeMakkah. The King Ahasuerus chooses to appoint Haman the Agagi, goes back to Agag as we discussed earlier, and he is established over everyone. What happened? Up in heavens, Midas Adin walked in before God and said, Haman went from Shushan to stop the building of the Beis HaMikdash, and Ahasuerus wants to establish him over everyone else. And his position in the government is going to be the top position. And God said, until now, I haven't been known throughout the world the way I want. Now let him go up, and from up there we'll cut him down. And then I'll pay him back for all the things he and his forefathers did to the Jewish people. So Haman is being brought up, and he doesn't know that the bigger they come, the harder they fall. That God in heaven wants him to be brought up so that from that status is where he'll be knocked down. Yeah.
He wasn't known the way he wanted to be known. What about the 10 plagues after
Okay,
time?
Right. So, I think that the Medrash is referring to Haman. Haman isn't well known yet. Haman has to be more well known. Haman has to be uplifted. If I destroy Haman now, no one will know about it. I want Haman to be in a position where everyone sees where he was. Yeah.
No, and what he said today, Rabbi Yitzhak gave a very big point on this, which I probably won't be able to say as he said it, but he was talking about there is a concept that really Hashem, the revelation in the world was completed through the Jewish people in at this time that that it was completed also in the physical sense. That the I don't know if it's a mirror you said, but the Vilna Gaon said that we at this time we accepted the Torah per Ratzon.
Right. The Gemara says that Kimu v'Kiblu, that the Jews accepted the Torah and the Ratzon this time.
All in Purim.
Right. It's after the destruction of the second of the first temple, only during this story of Purim do the Jews accept the Torah willingly. The Torah Shebaal Peh. Torah Shebichsav they accepted. Torah Shebaal Peh they were forced. Before we continue, we have to have another introduction. Years earlier, Ahasuerus had two battalions going out to war, and they had limited rations, and the two generals were known as Mordechai and Haman, and they were on the same side. They were going out to war, and Haman and his men finished their rations. They didn't measure their stuff out. They just gobbled it all down. And Mordechai instructed his men to take things slowly. He kept rationing the amount of food that was given out so that they'd have enough. And they're standing in the middle of the desert on their way to war, and Haman comes to Mordechai and he says, "My men have no more food." And Mordechai says, "Yeah, you have a problem." And Haman says, "My men are going to die." And Mordechai says, "I'm very sorry to hear that." And Haman says, "Give me some of your food." Mordechai says, "No." Haman says, "What do you mean, no?" Mordechai says, "We both took out rations. You chose to let your men just eat up everything they had. So I need to save what I have for my men." Haman says, "Yeah, but we're on the same side." Mordechai says, "Yeah, but I can't let my men die." So Haman says, "Yeah, but if you divide and your men eat a little bit less, then you'll have enough for my men." Mordechai says, "Yeah, you're right. But you chose to do this to yourself." Haman says, I'll pay you for it." Mordechai says, "No." Haman says, "I'll pay you X, Y, Z." He keeps upping the ante. Mordechai says, "No." And Haman finally says, "You know what? I'll be your slave. I'll give myself up as your slave if you give my men food." And Mordechai says, "Yeah, but you know what? Let's just write it. Let's write a contract to make sure that it's written that you're my slave." And Haman says, "Okay, where do you want to write it?" So Mordechai says, "On the bottom of my shoe." So they etch out on the bottom of Mordechai's shoe, "I, Haman, am hereby giving myself over. I am Mordechai's slave." And now the decree is out that everyone should bow down to Haman. And everyone's bowing. And when Haman comes near Mordechai, Mordechai just picks up his shoe and reminds him who's boss, and doesn't bow. Now Haman decreed that he is a god. He is an idol. And he, according to one medrash, he wore an ornament that was an idol, so that when the Jews bowed to him, they're in effect bowing to an idol. And Mordechai won't bow. So the servants all ask Mordechai, why aren't you listening? The king commanded. And this is a common claim. People sometimes take this as pressure. Aren't you a loyal citizen? That's how the Jews started their servitude in Egypt. They were asked, "Aren't you loyal citizens?" Even Paro was going out to work. So the tribe of Levi said, "Yeah, we're loyal citizens, but we're rabbis. We have to learn Torah. That's our job." So everyone else went to work the first day with Paro, and the tribe of Levi said, "We don't leave this matters. We have to learn." So the tribe of Levi were always honored in Egypt. No one said, "Oh, they're not loyal citizens." They were honored. But all the Jews that wanted to be loyal citizens, slowly but surely things changed around, and the Egyptians started making them work. The first day, Paro was part of the workforce. The next day, only the Egyptians. And then slowly but surely, it became that the Jews were working, and they were second-class citizens and third-class, until finally, they were the lowlifes of town, and everyone could make the Jews work. And the Egyptians trained the Jews to think that they were a lower caste. They were at the bottom of Egyptian society. They were slaves. It all began with the Jews wanting to be loyal citizens. So we mentioned earlier that Jews always were loyal citizens, but not in contradiction with the Torah. So now everyone's bowing to Haman, and they're coming to Mordechai, and they're saying, "Why don't you bow to Haman? Aren't you a faithful citizen? Don't you listen to what the king said?" And Mordechai says, "No, I am a Jew. I believe in one God. I don't bow to other things." And they say, let's see if Mordechai lives up to his word. So they go and they tell Haman. And when Haman sees this, so Haman gets upset. And Haman and Mordechai know that Mordechai doesn't have to bow to Haman. Quite the contrary. Haman is Mordechai's servant. And this gets Haman even more riled up. So So when Haman sees that Mordechai won't bow down to him, Haman starts burning from within, and he says, it's not enough that that I take care of Mordechai. I want to get rid of Mordechai's whole family. Because Mordechai comes from his great-great-grandfather Jacob. And his great-great-grandfather Jacob took from my great-great-grandfather Esav. We know Esav was the grandfather of Amalek, who was the grandfather of Agog, who was the grandfather of Haman. He took from him the rights to being firstborn. And my great-great-grandfather was made to wail at the hands of his great-great-grandfather. When Yaakov stole the rights to the firstborn, Esav wailed. And now it's payback time. That's why Mordechai is going to be forced to enter the city square and wail. Vayizach zaka gedola umara. Those are the same words that are used in describing how Esav wailed when he saw he was tricked out of the rights to the blessings.
And
what? Yeah, midak neged midah. And so Haman decides. What?
How many thousands of years?
Haman decides that he is going to wipe out all the Jews in Achashverosh's kingdom, and Achashverosh rules over the world. The Megillah begins Vayehi bimei Achashverosh, and our sages stress that Vayehi stems from the word Vay. Whoa, it's a terrible period. What was terrible about the period? So one understanding is that what was terrible is that the Jews were under one kingdom. All the Jews were under Achashverosh's rule, and so if this kingdom decided to persecute them, they had nowhere to run because Achashverosh ruled the world. And that is why when the Tower of Babel was built, God said, I have to intervene. Because when the Tower of Babel was built, the world had formed the UN, the United Nations, and they said, we're going to have one king. And that king is going to be who? Anyone? Nimrod, Amraphel. The one who wants to murder Avram and wants to get rid of those who want to bring God-fearingness into the world. To have a situation where the whole world is unified with one king named Nimrod, who wants to ensure that there is no monotheism, but rather people believe he is a god, and there are other gods, that Nimrod himself is a god, that can't be. So God has to intervene to ensure that Avram and his men can remain in the world. And so too here, when Haman decides that we have to wipe out Mordechai and the Jews, he is in essence threatening the existence of Jews and Judaism in the world.